Welcome to Navigating Consciousness. I'm Rupert Sheldrake, and this is a podcast of my talks and conversations. If you enjoy listening, please subscribe and leave a review in your favorite podcatcher. It really helps.
We titled this Unsolved Mysteries, the Science of Medicine. And probably the word mystery isn't really right. Maybe just unsolved puzzles of science and medicine, because I personally think mysteries are irreducible. The literal meaning of mystery is hidden. And mystery is something that can be experienced but not understood. And I don't think it's the business of science to make mystery go away. I once heard the Terence McKenna say that the bigger you build a bonfire, the more you become aware of the extent of the darkness. And I love mystery in the universe. But there are a lot of puzzles out there, things that we don't understand, the challenges to our way of thinking. And I might start with a mundane form of medicine. I've always been fascinated about where diseases come from. Diseases that were non-existent or rare that suddenly become very common and popular. And what are the explanations for these things? So one of the conditions that fascinates me is gluten sensitivity. And I have no idea what this is about, but I'll give you some speculation about it. Gluten is the main protein in wheat and many other grains. Actually, it's not present in formed fashion in wheat. There are precursors there, which when flour and yeast with water come together to form the gluten. And this happens in many other grains as well. Wheat has been a staple of human life in a sustained way for millennia. And why suddenly now should people be developing all the sensitivity to wheat and related grains? Really seems unknown as best. And the extent of this is tremendous. How many people in this room are gluten sensitive or any people who are gluten sensitive? So where did all this come from? And what does it mean? I was in China last fall, and you may know that in Chinese cooking, gluten is actually a food. I used to, in the old days, I used to make bread and a lot, and sometimes I would make gluten. Have any of you ever done this at home? You flour, water dough. What's easier is white flour. And then you knead the bowl of dough underwater, and the water becomes milky with starch, and you keep pouring it off and replacing with fresh water. And eventually, the water is clear, and the dough shrinks to about a third of its mass, and looks like a massive rubber band. And this pure gluten. And then you can take that protein and deep fry it or boil it in a broth. And the Chinese prepare this pure wheat protein in a variety of sauces. Gluten sensitivity is unknown in China. That's very nice. So why suddenly in our population are we seeing this rise in gluten sensitivity, which manifests in all sorts of ways? Now, there is a classic disease that's been known for a long time called celiac disease, in which there is sensitivity to gluten that's tested for in a variety of ways, causes intestinal havoc if people eat gluten, and if gluten is removed from the diet, there's great improvement. But now we're seeing constellations of symptoms related to this, allergies, confusion, mental fog, a whole range of symptoms. And when people are tested, there are various tests we have, document gluten sensitivity, and if gluten is removed from the diet, often things improve. So I'll tell you some of the explanations that have been proposed for this, and I don't think we have an answer to it. One is that we've been breeding strains of wheat for higher and higher gluten content. So the amount of gluten that people are getting may be higher than ever before. Another possibility, and this was suggested to me by Michael Pollan, who was writing an article on the subject, is that the traditional way of making bread involved a long, slow fermentation. This is the way of making traditional sourdough bread or bread from the datum starter, and that the fermentation process may break gluten down in a way that's prevented whatever is happening now, whereas modern bread making, which is instant, and there's just instant rise with yeast and no fermentation process, may be exposing us to gluten in a form that people never got previously. Another possibility that I've come across is that it may have to do with the rise of cesarean liver in our population. Because when babies are born vaginally, they are exposed to a variety of antigens which enter through the mouth that condition immune function. When babies are born by C-section, their first contact is often with the skin of the mother. And the skin has a very different microflora on it. And the rates of C-section in North America and China are very different. That's an interesting possibility. At any rate, I have no idea what this is about, you know, why we're seeing this tremendous rise in this phenomenon in our population. And associated with this, we're also seeing rises in other forms of allergy. In general, asthma and allergy are greatly increasing in the Western world. One of the particular forms that was rare to the point of being a medical curiosity when I was in medical school when I was growing up was peanut allergy, which is now, you know, epidemic to the point that many airlines don't serve peanuts anymore. And again, where did this come from? Why are we seeing this? There was an interesting article in the New Yorker a few months ago on this question. And I told Rupert about this earlier. One of the pieces of data they cited was a comparative study of a population of children in Israel and a population of Jewish kids in London of the same genetics. And the rates of peanut allergy were much, much higher in the UK than in Israel. And this was attributed to the fact that in Israel there's a kind of junk food made from peanuts. That is common, yes, that's very common, and that all young kids are given. And it may be that the exposure by that route, by the oral route at a young age, produces protective antibodies, whereas again, it may be skin sensitization through various cosmetic products, lotions that are peanut-based or have peanut oil in them that may stimulate allergy. And the authors of this article eventually came back to the hygiene hypothesis, which I'm sure many of you have heard of, that's gaining a lot of traction in medicine today. The hygiene hypothesis states that many of the diseases that we're seeing today, especially asthma and allergies, are due to the fact that we are obsessively clean, and that obsessive cleanliness, especially in young kids, prevents them from exposures to antigens early in life, which condition immune function in a healthy way, and that if we prevent this, so that these exposures don't take place later, the consequences are much worse. And peanut, the rise of peanut allergy may be one aspect of that.
Well, I mean, this health hypothesis, the why we've not enough antigens, what surprises me most about it is we haven't already got a product on the market. Germ concentrates. I would expect the wild germ concentrates for the best. It's been shown in England that children who get asthma are very often people who've been raised in very healthy, clean, hygienic conditions. And the first epidemiological evidence, as far as I know, was when they found that children raised on farms and around animals had a much lower incidence of asthma. And that then suggested this was because of antigens from farms and animals, and people with pets get it less than those without. So it shouldn't be too difficult to produce farmyard concentrates concentrates and produce the capsules of healthy germs, even vaginal extracts. A whole new market in vaginal germs. For children born by cesareans. I mean, the mothers could do it themselves, of course. Actually, these are all preventable conditions.
And when I was researching spontaneous happiness, I came across one very interesting paper on this subject that makes it look as if exposure to dirt may have an antidepressant effect. And that it was recommended that one get one's hands in dirt, inhale dust, not wash vegetables thoroughly, and it's been traced to a particular organism, a mycobacterium, a common harmless soil bacterium that in mice appears to induce changes in brain neurotransmitters. The hypothesis is that getting some dirt into your system is good for your mood as well as for your immune system.
So, but is anyone actually doing research on jet supplements in children?
No. Well, children are quite creative at finding.
I know, you're obviously not creative enough. Yeah. Well, I think that the another of the things you mentioned earlier to me was this rise in autism. Do you think this is related to?
Well, this is really a big, this is a big puzzle. There is a tremendous rise in autism or the spectrum of autistic disorders today. Again, when I was in medical school, these were fairly rare. Now they're extremely common. So the first question with any of this is how much of this is due to a different diagnostic criteria? Are we diagnosing in a way that we weren't before? Are we categorizing behaviors that before would have been dismissed as eccentric or odd, and we now put them under this umbrella? So certainly some of that is going on, but there does seem to be a true rise in the prevalence of autism. Many theories have been put forward about this. I mean, you've all heard the one about vaccines. I think that has been fairly thoroughly disproved by science, although it still has a lot of traction with the general public.
Yes.
I don't think there's any truth to that.
I agree with that.
It has been assumed that there is a strong genetic basis for autism, but that has recently been questioned as well, that the concordance of identical twins may not be as strong as it was seen. There's a lot of suspicion about environmental toxicity, which remains unproved, although certain drugs taken during pregnancy seem to be associated with it. And then most recently, there was a paper documenting a significantly higher incidence of autism in the children of mothers who've taken antidepressant drugs during pregnancy. This is the latest in an accumulating body of evidence against antidepressants, which I'll be happy to come back to at some point. So the environmental toxicity one certainly remains that's viable, although we don't know what. It's known that the age of parents has something to do with it, especially fathers. The older the father, the higher the chance. So really no one knows. It's unknown. And clearly there are specific neurological and psychological problems, but this remains a big puzzle. And if you go Google on autism and look at the various sites, there is no answer out there.
Well, I wanted to bring up with you some questions which go perhaps even deeper than these, but considerably deeper, in fact, extremely provocative.
Good.
In writing my book, The Science Delusion, which incidentally, The Science Delusion is the belief that science already knows and understands the nature of reality in principle, leaving any of the details to be filled in. That is The Science Delusion, and it's very common today. In the book, I outline 10 fundamental dogmas of bloody science, and then I turn them into questions. And one of the dogmas that I turn into a question, it was to me the most surprising of them all, because I'd questioned 9 of them for years. But the one I'd never questioned, and only started to question last year, was the principle of conservation of matter and energy, the belief that the total amount of matter and energy is always the same. We've all been taught this at school. And I'd assumed it must be totally true that to many places of decimals. It turns out that this is the most unstable and questionable of almost all the dogmas. First of all, physicists themselves have ignored it because they now have created, invented dark matter and dark energy, which now together make up 96% of the universe. Regular matter and energy that these laws apply to that we've heard about in school are only 4% of reality. So dark matter and dark energy, they've just invented at will to make their equations balance, and the amounts change year by year. So they can, since 2000, they've invented dark energy. Dark matter is about 20 or 30 years old. But, so first of all, they've created huge amounts of matter and energy which have accounted for various equations. Second, the energy density of dark matter, according to cosmological equations, is constant. That means the amount of energy per unit volume remains the same. And last summer I was reflecting on this, gazing out at sea here on Cortes Island, when it occurred to me, if the energy density is constant and the universe is expanding, which it is, the total amount of energy must be going up because the volume is increasing. So to keep the same density, it has to be more energy. That means the universe is generating more energy as it goes along, and therefore is a kind of perpetual motion machine. So I emailed a cosmologist friend and said, have I misunderstood this? And he emailed back and said, unfortunately, no. The amount of energy, according to modern cosmology, is increasing. So this law is this vast amount of energy. Then there's the dark, the zero-point energy field, the quantum vacuum field, which is the basis of all modern quantum physics. Every interaction between light and matter is mediated by what are called virtual photons that appear in the vacuum of space and disappear back into it. I mean, there's every interaction underneath everyone's bottom within this room, except for me and Andy, it's under our feet. There's a repulsive force that stops us going through the floor or our chair, and that's mediated by virtual photons. When you stand up, this high, this tremendous activity where your bottom is stops, and a greater amount of activity happens beneath your feet. Now, this is standard physics. It's in textbooks. Some people think you might be able to tap this, and lots of people have invented machines, above unity devices, machines that are supposed to produce more energy than you put into. These break the most fundamental taboo in physics, the taboo against perpetual motion machines. So they're always dismissed and get no traction. My proposal for that was to actual contest to find out which ones work best and have a big prize, $1 million or something, for the best above unity device. But the point that I want to get to is the most shocking of all, and this concerns humans. In the 1850s, it was assumed that human beings and animals obey the law of conservation of matter and energy. Until then, people thought that, the vitalists anyway, thought that humans and animals had a special kind of energy over and above the regular kind, called lighting energy. And that they differed from ordinary inanimate matter by having this extra energy. This was refuted by von Helmholtz in 1851, a German Edinburgh student at the time, and who visited Austin Hahn, a very great physicist, who argued that living organisms and machines, therefore they obey only the laws of physics and chemistry. Therefore, they obey the law of conservation of energy, therefore living organisms and machines. It was essentially a circular argument, and it wasn't based on evidence, but on kind of logical reasoning. People didn't test it till the 1890s with dogs in boxes, measuring the amount of heat that goes in and out. And they gave roughly the right answer. And then in 1910, around in the US, Atwater and Benedict, two researchers, did it with humans. They put them in calorimeters, measured all the heat they produced. People lived in these boxes for 3 weeks. Had oxygen going in, carbon dioxide coming out, urine, feces, food, weight gain, everything was monitored. And they came out with an answer that was 99.9% in agreement with theory. Everyone said the issue's settled, the last nail in the coffin, the vitalism, they're human beings, nothing but machines. And so saddened did this seem that no further research was done until the 1970s, when a maverick American nutritionist called Paul Webb, working in the Midwest, re-examined their work and did some new measurements in calorimeters. He found that there were huge discrepancies. Some people gave out 20-30% too much energy, others gave out 20-30% too little. There were massive discrepancies, huge errors. He then looked back at the original paper by Atwater and Benedict and found they'd found similar discrepancies, but they'd made sure that the number of people who were too high was exactly the same as the number too low. So the others came up exactly to get the right answer. So this then made me think, well, maybe there really is something peculiar about this. And after all, Hindus claim prana and Chinese claim qi, a form of energy that don't exactly map onto our ordinary energy. So then I thought, well, if this is so, there may be huge and obvious discrepancies. Then I thought of the inedia phenomenon. Inedia means fasting, and there have been reports from all over the world of people living without food. Now, this defies not only science but common sense. And it's, of course, a remarkable thing when it seems to happen. Jill and I visited an Indian woman who was a kind of saint in Rajasthan called Sati Math, who was said not to have eaten for more than 30 years. We visited her, she looked perfectly normal, and I, of course, assumed that she must have eaten separately in the evenings, and her devotees were so blinded by faith they couldn't see it. I had no evidence for this hypothesis, it was just a knee-jerk assumption. Then I found there were many others. There was one recently examined in India only a few months ago, by a team of physiologists who worked from your army, and they could find no cheating at all. Then there's a whole literature of Catholic saints in the book by a Jesuit scholar called Father Thurston, published in the 50s, called Physical Phenomena of Mysticism. There's a detailed study of St. Teresa of Avila and a whole host of Roman Catholic saints, most recently that Teresa Neuberg in Bavaria in the 20th century, who was supposed to have eaten nothing, who was examined by doctors and their version of the inquiry. And then there are breatharians who make these pills today. So there's this bizarre literature which defies all our normal assumptions, and yet this phenomenon is reported all over the world, and something really peculiar seems to be going on. So I think this is a big unsolved mystery.
Yes, I first read about a non-eating Indian saint in the autobiography of a yogi, and there was a chapter on a woman saint who, as a young girl, had made some vow to a god, and in return was given a power. She was, when Yogananda visited her, I think she was in her 60s or 70s, and apparently had, you know, supposedly had been eating it all the time. There was, however, a Hindu guru, I can't remember his name, was in Los Angeles, who claimed to be a breatharian and was caught on a video camera in 7-Eleven, stuffing himself with candy bars. So the question of fraud here is one that has to be ruled out. Now, the one that you referred to, there was an article in the New York Times about this man, who was being examined by the Indian army and a team of doctors, and they had him in confinement and were observing everything. So, you know, this is the kind of documentation that we used to see in reverse. But I agree, this is a great, you know, a great puzzle to confirm.
Yes. But you see, it could, it's not as if nutritional science is the most successful branch of science.
No.
I mean, the world has a billion people are overweight, there's no agreed diet systems. You know, this is a hugely confused area. And so if I were running nutritional science philosophy, waiting to see this, I encourage people to do research. You're a new teacher, seeming
less energy. Absolutely. There's, I think, a lot of mysteries about that. There are people who eat relatively little and gain weight and can't lose weight, and there are people who eat vast amounts of food and never gain weight. And even very interesting stories. I know many many Americans who have gone on trips to Italy and France, especially, were very concerned about their weight and decided that they're just going to throw caution to the wind for several weeks and eat everything and anything, and got back home to find that they had actually lost a bit of weight and were amazed at that. Now, does that have to do with different quality of food? They said that their activity was not that much different. I don't know, but there are mysteries here.
It's the wheat.
Well, another one is the work on carrying loads on the head by women in Africa and India. And anyone who's been to Africa or India will have seen this practice of carrying huge loads on the head. Now, there was a study published in Nature just 3 or 4 years ago that showed that in East Africa, women could carry up to 30% of their body weight for miles without expending any more energy than just walking there with no load at all. So this is a big anomaly. And then they found they could carry 70% of their body weight while using 50% less energy than US Army recruits, carrying the same amount of weight in backpacks. So there's huge differences in energy usage here. Now, whether this is explained through just the way they move or they're gait or something, or whether there's some energy mystery, I don't know, but this is the kind of thing scientists on the whole don't examine, and yet would seem one of the most interesting things to examine. And, you know, apart from anything else, why aren't they teaching kids in school how to carry legs on their heads? Because you can keep them in West and lug around suitcases if they have the wheels break on their suitcase. They're terribly bad at carrying heavy weights. Whereas here's a known, tried and trusted method, which has been used for centuries from the millennia. And it would seem worth learning how to do this.
Now, Rupert, I would like to bring up a deeper issue. This is right up for alley. One of the most interesting articles that I read in the past year appeared also in the New Yorker, and this is from the December 15th, 2010 issue under the Annals of Science Department. It's called The Truth Wears Off by Jonah Lehrer. And this is about a phenomenon that has been documented more and more recently called the decline effect in scientific research, which is that findings which seem unshakable, as experiments are repeated, become less and less replicable. And this is something being observed in pharmaceutical research, in psychology, in a number of other fields, and it's very distressing. And when all various explanations are put forward and given statistical problems, it looks as if there's something irreducible here, and this article certainly posits the possibility that there may be a limit to what we can know and what we can prove scientifically, and that, and the subtitle of this is there something wrong with the scientific method? And this would fit right in with your idea that there is something delusional here about thinking that we can figure everything out. And when we think we have something figured out, as we do more and more experiments, it becomes less and less true.
Well, I too read this article when it came out and was completely fascinated by it. And then I got a lot of people emailing me saying, could this be due to morphic resonance? They call it cosmic habituation on the article. In some cases it could, morphic resonance is a kind of habit forming principle. But for me, the question really is, well, why do some things decline and others don't? I mean, the science on which our technologies are based, like light bulbs, computers, motion cars, and things, doesn't seem to decline, otherwise these machines would stop working after a while. It's only certain kinds of phenomena. And if the decline effect was first made conscious in parapsychology, and at least it's one of the places where it first showed up, it occurs in medicine too, of course, we'll come back to that. But Jonathan Schuller, who was the main advisor for this article, is a parapsychologist, and was interested with some effects fall off in parapsychology. They don't all, though, and there's been an intense debate among parapsychologists in the last year about this phenomenon. I myself found a big decline effect in one of my exams on precognition just a few months ago. I invented a new online precognition test. The first 500 trials were giving huge, massive effects that would have changed our whole views of causality. The next 500, it was much weaker, but still positive. The next 500, it had disappeared almost to nothing. If I'd published the paper on the first 1,000 results, I would have had a massive, world-shattering result, but it fell off. And I was very baffled by this because some of my other experiments don't show decline effects. In this particular case, I worked out that in the experiments, if people had to choose one out of four options, which meant the chance level was 25%, people who were doing well were getting 30%, which is 5% of our chance. But what that meant is that in these tests, they were wrong 70% of the time. Now, when people do these tests, when I do them myself, and I'm wrong most of the time, even if I'm scoring about chance, so I get demoralized, discouraged, and so on. I'm also aware, during the research of this kind, that the more positive the results, the stronger the skeptical attacks become. And I begin to doubt my own experiments when these skeptical attacks pour in. So I thought this might be a demoralization effect, and subsequent people taking the test by morphic resonance might start off demoralized under the influence of people who've done it before. So I've changed my experimental design as a result of reading this article. I've just launched in the US, not yet in Canada, a new version of my automated telephone telepathy test. And this is a test, the well-known phenomenon, you think of someone, then they call, and you say, that's funny, I just think she's. Is it telepathic? I've done lots of research on this, I think it is. In most of my tests, people have four choices. The four people, you get one of four people they know well to ring, randomly selected. The phone rings before they see, no, it's a landline, no caller ID. Before they pick up, they have to guess who it is, and then they answer it, they're right or wrong. By chance, they'll be right 25%. On average, they write 45% in these tests. But what I've done, that began to show a slight decline effect. So I've now switched it so you have two callers. It's a 50% chance rate, so you're not going to be wrong most of the time, and most people score above chance. And in other experiments of mine where there's 50% chance if late, I've not seen any decline effect. In my experiments on the sensitivity and stalemate, for example. So I think part of it could be a demoralization effect. Part of it could be skeptical attitudes having an inhibitory effect on people, the participants who are up. And there could be other things as well.
Also, we don't know the time course of these. It may be that over a longer time course, you see a decline effect in some of these areas. This is a real problem. It's not just parapsychology. This is an article in a mainstream publication, and this is a major problem now in medical research, where results of drug testing fail to be replicated, and this has great implications for how we use drugs in treatment. It left me wondering, something that I had thought before, that there's a kind of trickster element out there in the universe that doesn't let us see what's behind the curtain. And that this comes back to the irreducible mystery, that we're foiled in asking certain questions, we're trying to figure everything out, that there are limits to knowing and limits to using the scientific method to understand. I thought it was a very provocative article.
Well, he gives many examples, some in medicine where placebo effects could play a part. And actually the opposite in relation to, see which way you look at it. One of the things that interests me a lot recently is decline effect in drug trials by American drug companies of the new drugs. Fewer and fewer are passing their tests because the placebo effect is going up. You've been tracking that one. So the placebo effect is getting stronger, which means the drugs, the new drugs, aren't better than placebos. Placebos are getting better. one popular explanation for this is that placebo effects don't occur equally in all cultures. I recently read a book on medical anthropology. It's very fascinating. And it showed the placebo effects in America for most modern prescription drugs are bigger than they are in Europe. One explanation was that since the scrapping of regulation against direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs, American drug companies have spent so much on advertising, they've so raised American expectations of the powers of drugs, that when they say that there's a new drug being tried and you might be getting it, the placebo effect is huge. And so the drug companies, in a way, have shot themselves in the foot. In Europe, there isn't direct-to-consumer advertising of drugs, so the effect is approximately big. There are also very big differences in placebo effects of heart drugs in Germany and in other countries. The Germans turn out to be obsessed with hearts. Yeah. They die of heart attacks as much as anyone else, but it's an obsession in Germany, the health of the heart. And you get very different placebo effects with heart medication in Germany than you do with even more drugs.
Sure.
Well, we've still got another 7 or 8 minutes to cover what some of the most profound mysteries. So the one I think that we should piece of today's bit for a very long time, but the biggest mystery of all, or unsolved problem, I think in this case a mystery, is the sheer existence of consciousness. This is something that the science as we now know it cannot handle. Because science is based on the materialist assumption that the only reality is matter. Therefore, our consciousness must be a kind of illusion produced by our brains, either an epiphenomenon like a shadow of brain activity, or just another way of talking about brain activity, that what's really going on is material. And consciousness was ignored by science, even psychology, until about 20 or 30 years ago. I mean, after all, most 20th century psychology was based on behaviorism, which was the doctrine that the only things you can measure scientifically are muscular changes in, and glandular secretions, that you couldn't talk about the mind because it was a non-scientific concept.
May I yes. interject? I was a, as an undergraduate, I was a student of B.F. Skinner. He was my advisor. And I had gone into psychology with the intention of studying consciousness. That interested me. Actually, it was prior to that, I had a brief stint as a linguistics major. And at Harvard, you have to combine linguistics with another field. Most people combine it with a language. I tried to combine it with psychology, and I was interested in questions such as, does the language you speak influence your experience of reality? More than Eskimos, they have seven different words for snow, or they say differences that we don't. I think there's great. Anyway, I could not get any headway. The Harvard Linguistics Department was entirely about mathematical analysis of language, and I was discouraged from having anything to do with psychology. So after a half year of that, which was very frustrating, I switched to psychology and fell under the spell of Skinner. And he's a very captivating lecturer, articulate. And then at some point, the ridiculousness of trying to study consciousness in a system that denied, that tried to explain everything without relation to consciousness. It was extremely frustrating, and I went into botany, which was much more interesting. Interestingly, although I didn't know it at the time, there was a whole movement beginning in psychology, which ironically came out of the field of artificial intelligence. And it was artificial intelligence and computer code writing that first provided a model for understanding the working of the mind. The dogma before that was that the mind was inaccessible to scientific study, and computer modeling gave an opening into that, and that led to the rise in cognitive psychology, which placed the workings of the mind front and center. So this was a real change.
Yes, but it's cognitive psychology with the computer model itself is now being superseded by, I think, rather better approaches in psychology. One thing that's happened is that psychologists have discovered emotions. Computers don't have emotions. So now the really big things in current psychology are that emotions, which are to do with the body and the whole body, the way the body reacts, the fight or flight reaction, adrenaline and stuff, the emotions affect the way we think and the way we respond. Now, this is big news in psychology. It's probably not big news to most people in this room. Then the fact that we're embodied, and the state of the art in consciousness studies is theories of embodied lives, that our lives are embodied and react in an embodied way to the world. Whereas computers gave this kind of disembodied model of intelligence. But I think since we've got a limited time, we should bring this back to measurable phenomena in the realm of medicine. And two of the areas where the effect of the mind on the body, three areas where these things really make a difference is, first of all, the power of belief in placebo effects, which we touched on. Second, the way that in hypnosis you can actually affect bodily responses, like the hypnotic induction of blisters. And thirdly, it's one of Andy's favorite subjects, reading his book on Integrated Principles of Integrated Medicine. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, it was spontaneous.
Yes. About he has a whole section on magical cures for warts, which is fascinating because warts can be cured magically, and they really aren't cured. So one of the things he calls for is research on this subject, because there's so many methods of magical wart cure. They actually work, and they show the mind must influence the body. You'd think this would be a really important area for medical research to look at.
Well, it has not been still. And it fascinates me that something that's right in front of our faces that's so dramatic, that scientists don't see this for its importance. First of all, when magical wart cures work, they work instantly, very often overnight. And I've collected volumes of different ways of doing this. Everything from rubbing a cut potato in a wart and burying the potato in their particular kind of tree to be touched by the neighborhood wart healer. All sorts of. But there's a commonality. Often someone will do this at night and the next morning the wart falls off. Or another pattern is over the next few days the wart shrinks and falls off. And compared to the way we treat warts in medicine, which is to burn them off or freeze them off with nitrogen or use a they got caustic chemical on them. In those instances, typically better than 50% of instances, the warts should grow in multiple clusters. And the magical cure is quite precise. Warts are, this is highly disordered tissue infected by viruses. And obviously what happens here is some activation of an immune response very suddenly, which rejects the tissue. I can't think of anything more important to figure out, you know, how that happens and how to make it happen more of the time. You know, wouldn't we like to do this with cancers and many other conditions? And that mechanism is there. In hypnosis, which has never been really become legitimized in medicine, it's still marginal. I think the basic principle is that wherever you have nerves, you have mind, and that's everywhere in the body. And so there's nothing potentially beyond the reach of the influence of suggestion and mind and belief. So I don't think there's any limit to the placebo response. And the question is how to take advantage of it and use it more.
I think our designated time is up, and we agreed that we'd ask Rick to ask the first question. And then we're going to open it up. So if you,
yeah, thank you. Well, as I mentioned here, I thought this is probably a supportive of grief that she's going to address. We really are interested in some of your inner life as well. So I'll just pose the question in a general way, and you can take whatever you like, but both of you are nature lovers. And you were botanist, you're a biologist, physician. There's hope, I think, if we go deeper into our spiritualized or state of the world. And I'm looking for some sense from each of you of, you know, what is the relationship between our humanness, our spirituality, and nature? How that look for you?
In less than 2 minutes,
yes. No.
Well, obviously, we're part of nature. Our bodies have evolved. We're animals. We've evolved. We live in a natural world, and we totally depend upon it. So we're in the earth, not on the earth. This is a point David Abram makes, and it's actually an old view. In the authorized version of the English Bible, published at the beginning of the 17th century, the Lord's Prayer says, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. And I think that's very interesting. We're in the earth, we're part of nature. Our spiritual life is tied up with the fact that we're part of something much bigger than ourselves. And I think that any form of spirituality that leaves out the natural world is obviously an instinct. I mean, in fact, all traditions have embraced and included it to varying degrees. So my own belief is that we are connected to a greater mind or consciousness than our own. And that's expressed through the whole natural world. And for me, part of my spiritual practice is spending time every day, if I can, in the natural world. I tell you, we're fortunate to live next to the biggest open space wilderness area in London, Hampstead Heath. So I walk on Hampstead Heath most days. Here on Court Island, it is easy to be in a natural place and connect with plants, animals, the sky, the clouds, the earth. I think that's an essential part of remaining sane and remaining human. And I believe there's many examples of all religious traditions of people who've done this. The Judaic tradition is rooted in this as well, the Judeo-Christian tradition. I'm rereading the Old Testament at the moment. And it's fascinating how often when Abram has revelations, they happen under sacred trees, everything is in the sacred stone, Bethel. The Old Testament is full of sacred places and a story that's rooted in the land and in place. About the spiritual story is tied up with the natural story. And so if that's really there at the very core, in the very roots of the Judeo-Christian tradition, as it is in others.
I think this connection from nature is a major factor in the rise of depression and other mental and emotional bills that we see today.
There's even been a term proposed of nature deficit disorder.
DSM, but a few years ago, I got to go on, I don't know if it was something I really wanted to do, but I was taken on a tour of a nuclear submarine that was somewhere near Seattle at the base there. And it was horrifying to me on all sorts of levels, but mainly because there was not one natural thing in that environment. I mean, literally not one. There was not a plant, except for the humans that were there. Of course, they were all young kids, but I think really had no idea what they were about. But it was, I couldn't imagine living in that environment, and they were down for 6 months in Pepperdine. And it was complete distraction. But many people today live in cities and in buildings where you can't open windows, who really never get to see stars, who are completely unaware of the changes of the sky and so forth. And I think this has profound consequences on our spiritual life, on our emotional life. I grew up in a city, and so it was really not until my late 20s when I got out and began to live in nature, and now I can't imagine, you know, not doing that. So whether it's the desert in Arizona or here in the Northwest, that's a huge part of my life. I also experience nature as fundamentally, how should I say this? I mean, obviously nature is both terrifying and beautiful, but I really experience it mostly as benign and a source of wonder. And I'm astonished at people who are so fearful of nature. I see this coming out in all sorts of ways. One, as you know, I'm very interested in mushrooms, and I spent a lot of years studying mushrooms of all kinds. And I meet so many people who think that if you touch a mushroom out in the forest, you can get sick or die. The fact is that there are very few mushrooms that can kill you. And there are relatively few that are delicious and fabulous. Once you know the ones that can kill you and avoid them, you have a lot of latitude to try things. And I've eaten a lot of mushrooms that books say are of unknown edibility. Then I've discovered some that were very good. And I never had any bad reactions to them. But that's because I know the ones that are deadly and I avoid them. But the things that are really harmful in nature are relatively few, at least a small percentage. That's the same with plants and animals. So I think that this fear of nature, which leads people to isolate themselves from it and shame from it, is quite peculiar to our culture today. And I think it's also stronger in the English-speaking world than it is in many other cultures. For instance, in the German-speaking world, I think there's a different attitude toward nature than you see in the English-speaking world. So that's just something I observe. I think living, opening oneself to natural influences is very helpful on many levels.
And Hollyhock plays a major part in this. There's two workshops going on at the moment, the naturalist one and the David Abram one, and this whole environment. And no one would be here on Curtis Island if they weren't interested in getting a deeper connection with nature. And you don't come here for urban conveniences.
Hi. Really interested in the decline effect. I hadn't run into that. I teach ethics in healthcare, and the manipulations of scientific data are just, you know, my bread and butter. One thing you didn't talk about, I mean, it could be the decline effect as a phenomenon, and there could be fundamental problems with scientific methods, but the part you didn't talk about is just basic bad science. Like the null results don't get published, or the pressure to get certain results, or the 30 above and the 30 below, and it comes out even. And there's some estimates like 50-70% of medical articles are not worth reading. What's your take on that?
I couldn't agree more. I think the enormous percentage of enormous amount of research has never been done in the first place. You know, the questions that nobody should even bother asking, and then it just clutters the literature with useless information.
and contributes to what's been called data smog. Rupert and I are both very much interested in editorial bias in scientific journals. This is particularly true of medical journals, although editors vigorously deny it. The influence now of the pharmaceutical companies on medical journals is overwhelming, and there's enormous pressure to reject articles showing negative findings and to publish those that show positive findings for drugs. And this has had terrific practical effects on the way we prescribe things. There with antidepressants, which I've just written about in this book, there's a very powerful body of evidence showing that these work no better than placebos, and that's shocking. These are prescribed and so incredibly. So I think there's not only a lot of bad science, there's a lot of distorted science. There's a lot of conscious, and then this is all magnified in the general media. Just one example I'd give you, six or seven years ago, there was results were published of very large NIH-funded multi-center trial looking at comparing Zoloft and St. John's Wort and placebo in the treatment of severe depression. First of all, St. John's Wort is not indicated for severe depression, so they shouldn't even have looked at that. It was for mild to moderate depression. And the finding that was published and emphasized was that St. John's Wort worked no better than a placebo. And this was front page news in American newspapers around the world. I remember a CNN report in it, which the reporter was an alpha store, pointing to shelves of St. John's Wort and saying people were wasting their money and how stupid. The finding in the paper that was not publicized was that Zoloft worked no better than a placebo. And that also, in fact, St. John's Wort worked slightly better than Zoloft, and the placebo worked better than both of them. But that got no publicity. It was all that St. John's Wort was worthless.
Yes, there's a huge bias. First, when themselves people choose to publish, then in journals not publishing negative results or ones that they don't like or the referees reject. If the whole system is incredibly biased, if each of us could pick 5% of our data to put in our income tax return, you wouldn't the tax authorities get a rather distorting picture of our income and tax liability.
And with the medical journals, it's corrupted as well, because there's an enormous influence of money coming to the journals from the pharmaceutical company. So it's corrupt as well as the story.
I asked Rick to pick the question.
I'll stick up on this side of the room. I've heard of a product called Frulidil Arginine. It's the main ingredient is olive. And to claim this, if it lasts thousands, filters, arteries, liquefies black, and it's black is the form of the
blood itself.
There's a good body of data on L-arginine as a vasodilator, it looks something that can be useful for dilating coronary arteries and increasing blood flow. So I think that's reasonable. Whether all the claims that you read there are valid, I don't know, because there's a tremendous, in the marketing hype of these products, they're often outrageous claims, but there is good scientific evidence for the use of arginine.
There's one thing that I think it has in its favor, pharmaceuticals won't catch it.
Right. Yeah.
Probably.
But by the way, one principle I talked with Rupert is something that I wanted to mention. This I think goes deep as well. One of the most basic principles that in medicine, which I think is largely unappreciated, first enunciated by a great physiologist named Walter Cannon, who wrote a book called The Wisdom of the Body, which would be very distasteful to scientists today who are attributing wisdom to the human organism. But he posited the principle of homeostasis in staying in one place. And the basic idea is that the body seeks equilibrium, that if you push against it, it pushes back. And this has great consequences in terms of drug treatment. There's another article I brought along tonight that has identified a new condition called tardive dysphoria, which is prolonged depression caused by antidepressant drugs. And the fact is that if you
block serotonin reuptake. So you increase serotonin in the synapses. The body pushes back. It stops, the neurons stop making serotonin, and serotonin receptors disappear. So then the drug is producing the condition that's meant to stop. And this prolongs depression. But I think this is a general principle. Many of the ways that we treat the body in medicine, especially with pharmaceuticals, you push against it, and it's going to push back. And if you do that long term, you get yourself into worse trouble than you were to the end. Over here on the floor.
We've been talking about how the mind can affect the results, so whether it be the decline effect perhaps. Are you guys looking at different approaches to science? Or are our tools too coarse right now then to encompass that? Or how would you envision science being able to encompass that effect?
Well, that's a good question. And the traditional way of trying to deal with the experiments is expectations is to use blind techniques. Mm-hmm. That's what double-blind placebo-controlled trials are. They were put there in the first place because it was recognized that in psychology and medicine, the experimenter's expectation affected the results. In other words, the experimenter got the results they wanted, usually. Now, it's never been clear whether that's because they just report the observations that fit what they want to see, whether they bias the way they write it up, or whether they actually influence the system by some parapsychological mind-over-matter type effect. I personally think that's quite possible, but it's, of course, an immensely taboo topic within science. And blind experimentation is... I did a survey of blind experimentation in science. I found in parapsychology, about 85% of published papers involve blind efforts. In medicine, about 25%. In psychology, about 15%. In biology, 0.4%. In physics and chemistry, 0%. And I did a survey of scientists working in the hard sciences, and do you use blind methods? If not, why not? And most of them thought blind methods were only used because when you're working with human subjects, their expectations might bias the subject. The idea that they themselves might bias their results, scientists might not be as objective as they believe they were, didn't cross their minds. One professor of chemistry said, chemistry is hard enough as it is without making it even more difficult. So I've proposed in skeptical magazines as well as the scientific magazines a simple test where in an undergraduate practical class, say they're comparing an activated enzyme with a control, that half the class do it the normal way, where they're told which is which. The other half, they're labeled A and B. And you find out whether the results differ under blind from open conditions. I don't pretty think they would. I haven't been able to persuade a single researcher to do this. I got close to it with a school in England, the top school in England. The physics teacher, the head of physics, was really like this, and he agreed to do it. Then he called me and said, the head of science wants to talk to you, he was a chemist. I went to meet all the science department teachers, and I explained it to them. And I said to the head, and the head of science said, well, he said, it's obvious what will happen. He said, obviously people are going to get the results that they're expected to get. He said, it's obvious that's what science education is all about, getting the results, if we're going to do the standard results in standard experiments. And he said, if you do this experiment, he said, it's going to open a can of worms. I never want a can of worms opened in my school. So the thing is that there's an inherent bias, you see, within the scientific method.
There are very subtle nuances here. One of the assignments that I would regularly give medical students and doctors in training is to go to a medical library and pull out at random any medical journal that reports results of double-blind drug testing. Turn to the back of the article where there's a summary of the results. And you will always find in the control group, that is the one that got the placebo, one or two or a small number of subjects who show all of the changes produced in the experimental group. I mean, that's amazing. That means that any change that you can produce in the human organism by giving a drug can be exactly reproduced under some circumstances in some individuals purely by a mind-mediated mechanism.
You mean side effects?
Anything. Anything you can do with a drug can be exactly reproduced in some individuals purely by a mind-mediated mechanism. Furthermore, doctors believe in the results of double-blind trials. So drugs that do well in double-blind trials that they prescribe are going to produce better placebo effects because the doctors believe in them and their belief conditions patients believe that you can't disentangle this. And that comes back to the fact that you can't separate mind from body. And maybe you can't separate our consciousness from the consciousness of nature and the consciousness of the universe that's all pervasive. And maybe this is where we get into these tangles of trying to ask questions and we're not separate from the thing that we're trying to study and question.
Can we take a couple of more questions?
Yes, well, just one more point on that. Something that Andy and I have discussed in our schools was in medical research, I mean, this may sound like a council of despair, but actually, in medical research, if you compare outcomes, instead of double-blind placebo-controlled trials, you compare different treatment methods for conditions like cold sores or lower back pain. You know, do osteopaths, assign people at random to osteopaths, acupuncturists, homeopaths, physical therapists, anyone who claims to cure it, let them all have a go with a level playing field trial, which works best. Now that, which I used to call outcomes research, is now a major plank of US federal government policy. They've started an institute for comparative effectiveness research. And this is a way of actually comparing outcomes, what works. And some things work best than others. And if people say, okay, well, that one only works because it's got a bigger placebo effect, it doesn't matter. What matters is that it works, and works better.
Okay, we're running out of time, so we're going to take three brief questions. You and one back there, and that'll be it.
Yeah. I think fascinated by the conversation around placebo effects that now it seems to be becoming more effective. And I'm wondering, because I've studied Jung for a long time, Swiss psychologist, and one of the things he said, he talked about the shift in the collective unconscious and how it's configured. And it seems to me that we're experiencing that kind of shift, that we're becoming more intuitively based, that as a society, that we're becoming more sensitive. What he tells us would fit into what you're finding in all the scientists versus more often we need to get the root of the part.
Brief.
No, it's difficult to answer such a general question. I mean, I don't know whether we're becoming more intuitively based or not. I mean, there's certain ways in which I think that's true. There's certainly been a rise in interest in alternative and complementary medicine, even in pretty increasing official interest in integrated medicine. But whether that fits with Jung's views, I don't know, it's a complex thing.
I think that what elicits placebo effects changes from culture to culture and time to time, and that evolves, and it would be great if we could shape that. You know, for example, in the most of the 20th century, people had tremendous belief in failing technology, so that high-tech treatments were more likely to generate greater placebo effects, in addition to being more directly impactful. I think now it's possible that we're seeing a loss of collective belief in pharmaceuticals, for example, and technology, and maybe greater increased belief in natural treatment and plant medicines, for example. That would be very desirable. I'd like to sort of hasten that along. It would be great if people had greater faith in more dilute, less invasive treatments, and yet got the same healing effects from them. So I think that can evolve.
Over here.
I have a question for either of you. Because of the after effect of the massive thrombosis or flight, I have to give myself a shot of heparin, and my heparin needle had disappeared. As I was going through the security screen, I was hoping to find it. I asked them to reach up it on the x-ray machine. The two needles that I thought I had were there, including the vial with the heparin. We went through the entire bag, it was not there.
A mystery.
Well, this, as a matter of fact, this phenomenon is being studied by a woman in England called Mary Rose Farrington, who's in the Society of Psychical Research. And she's been documenting a phenomenon that she calls JOTS. Just one of those things. And she claims it's a very common experience for people to find something they knew they'd put somewhere and it's just not there. They look everywhere, they can't find it. And then it turns up later in some completely obvious place. I had this exact situation with Raking Grassy and his spectacles. There's a place where we like to swim, and he lost his specs, and a whole search party had been sent out. They looked absolutely everywhere, no one could find them. Crisis, no spectacles, you can't get new ones on Porter's Island very easily, all that. And then I went along there with him a few days later, and they're lying in the most obvious place, right in the middle, with the spectacles. So, how many people here have had job
they go into another dimension.
We're not there to show up the X-ray.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, that they may have appeared somewhere else.
No, they're
not. Well, not in your luggage. You're not in the
No, we all have this experience. And whether this is it's selective perception or I have no idea. It's very interesting.
But what the laser machine show something that
Barry.
I don't know. I have a question.
Yes, about food. Today when we were on our nature walk down of Manson's Lagoon, there were some wild cherries there, and of course I said to my group, oh, these are lovely, they're delicious, they're so great and sweet. And so a few of the group, of course, fell for the trap and had some of them, and they, of course, they were eating bitter cherries, and amargo, as they say in Spanish. So the question is, are bitter foods good for us? Which particular ones would you say are really good for us? And why are bitter foods good?
All right. We clearly have evolved a bitter taste sense to help us avoid things that are potentially toxic. Because many plant alkaloids are bitter, many harmful things are bitter. So we are born with an aversion to bitter taste. However, some bitter things are not toxic and are probably very good for us. I think in North America, particularly, we tend to shun bitter taste. And we're different from certain other cultures in that regard. The Chinese say that there are five primary tastes, one of which is bitter, and they say it's important to include a balance of all the flavors in your food. And they would probably say that our moderate consumption of sugar is a result of our avoiding getting enough bitter in our diet. There is one Western culture that is very striking in its love of bitter things. Can you tell me which that is? No? Italians, who have an amazing array of bitter vegetables that they like, and bitter liqueurs, of which, have you ever tasted Fernet Branca? I can't imagine how people use that. Now, a lot of these bitter principles, one of the things they do is stimulate the flow of digestive juices. And this is the basis of digestive bitters, most of which are made from gentian. That's the commonest bitter principle. Quinine is another common bitter. And often I recommend these to people who have sluggish digestions. There is a preparation called Angostura bitters, which is mainly a gentian root preparation. And you can put a tablespoon of this into some soda water and drink it before a meal or after a meal. Very good for digestion. So I think a main principle of the value of eating bitters is of improving digestion through increase of digestive enzymes.
Well, I just say as a postscript to that, my father was a pharmacist and a herbalist, and he worked in an era when people went to pharmacists first instead of going to doctors. It was, and he made up medicines for people. They asked him to make, they consulted and he'd make them special medicine. And so I used to help in the dispensary. I grew up in a pharmacy. Got to see how they were made. And I'd ask him, why do you put that in there? And he said, well, follow me, you've got to make the medicines taste nasty, because that's what people believe they were. So put in nasty tastes into these medicines. And this, I suppose, was a form of the placebo effect, where people felt that if they didn't taste good, they were going to be doing them good. And he was a tremendous believer in the placebo effect. He hardly ever took any drugs himself, because he said he knew too much about side effects. He took aspirin occasionally, but hardly ever took them. But And so I think some knew a large part of his practice was based on placebo effects, and he'd obviously refined methods that made guys' medicines more effective.
Give them a big round of applause.